Yeah, some of these shouldn't really be
really outrageous
with that.
Oh.
You know?
Yeah. All right, thank you.
Even with that.
Going to open the House Rural Interim Committee on Rural Communities. Today's November 21st. Welcome, everybody. We've got a few members who couldn't make it due to real life conflicts. And so let's move along. One of our guests today on the agenda is with a flat tire somewhere, probably on I-5. So we're going to move into our other two speakers. First I need to open an informational meeting. Then we're going to get into rural revitalization initiatives. And why don't I have Scott Hendrick come up. Scott's flown in from somewhere I know to talk to us.
Scott West.
Yeah. Oh, did I mix it up?
No, you're good.
Sorry. And the other Scott, come on up. So we usually give some latitude to those who travel a long way. So why don't you you want him to go first?
No,
you guys have a
go first. Well, I'm from Milwaukee, Oregon.
Oh, I thought you.
I'm the lawyer. Sure.
Which is
I
which?
Came from Denver, Colorado.
There we go. I should have known with the suit and the more Oregon style.
Yeah. No. You can go for it. We can just keep it. Should I go first?
Unless you've got it choreographed and worked out.
I'm from Milwaukee, Oregon.
Okay.
It's fine.
Yeah. You're welcome to stay, though.
I'm switching.
Well, thank you, Chairman Clem and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Hendrick, and I'm a program director at the National Conference of State Legislatures. Hopefully you are all familiar with NCSL and what we do, but if you're not, we are the leading national bipartisan organization that was put together to serve state legislatures. So we are here as part of those efforts to help you and the legislative staff with just research and analysis on issues. And I also want to mention that Senator Starr, your colleague in the other chamber, is our current president of NCSL right now. And he's done a lot for our organization over the years and is certainly doing a lot now. And so I appreciate the chance to come back and give a little bit back to Oregon here today. So one of our main missions at NCSL is to help share information on policy approaches between the states. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all today about rural affairs policies across the country. I've been asked to address what states are doing to promote agriculture tourism as a way to slow rural population decline. And so I'll touch on that base on that issue, but I'm also going to talk a little bit about some other trends that we're seeing and that states are developing in terms of just rural economic development generally. So those are sort of is a broad outline of my presentation today. Of course, promoting rural economic health is a concern that is shared by policymakers across the country in every state. I know this committee is well familiar with the challenges that are facing rural areas, not only in Oregon, but across the country. In a vast number of areas, jobs are harder to come by, populations are shrinking and aging, and infrastructure is crumbling and in need of repair. It's a big problem, and there are no easy answers. But I do like this quote by former Kansas State Senator Jeff King, who noted that while there's no one silver bullet solution to these issues, there are a lot of different smaller answers to these questions and these problems. The economics of rural America are also changing, and we know that decades ago, rural economies relied heavily on farm-based jobs. That's no longer the case. In fact, in 4 out of 5 rural economies are dominated by non-farm activities, including manufacturing, services, and government jobs. An important part of this picture is rural tourism and recreation. Recent federal government studies have found that these tourism and recreation development in rural areas leads to a number of benefits to the local community. These include increases in employment, in income and wage levels, and improvements in social conditions such as poverty, education, and health. So it's an important area to focus on. Of course, I couldn't begin to provide a complete overview of what every state is doing, not only on agritourism issues, but on rural economic development generally. So my approach today will be to provide a bit of an overview, to highlight some of the individual policies states are taking, and hopefully just share some information that may be helpful for this committee and for the state. Of course, I'm happy to provide any additional information or detail following today's hearing on any issues that I talk about today. So we'll start by taking a look at some states that have adopted more comprehensive approaches to promoting agriculture tourism, and we're going to focus in on some common elements that these states share or tend to share. So we'll look, and then we'll look at the individual policies and programs that support rural tourism, and that in some cases make up these comprehensive plans, and in other cases where states don't have comprehensive plans, some states nonetheless have adopted these individual policies, and so you see them being pursued in a number of areas around the country.
Before you go on,
yes.
Can I just ask you a quick question?
Absolutely.
If there were a problem statement that are why people are creating all these policies, why we're looking at this, is it that rural areas have lower income and unstable or non-growing populations?
Yes. Yes.
Or because kids move away and so many don't come back? Is that what you're hearing generally? Why is this activity, you know, from people like us? Why?
Yeah, Chairman Clem, thank you for that question. Yes, absolutely. There are significant economic challenges facing rural America. There's population decline is a big issue that we're seeing in a lot of communities. The average age of rural communities is growing, and in some cases reaching, you know, in their 50s and 60s of the average age of communities. And that is because, as you alluded to, in many cases, the younger generation is moving to urban areas and staying there and not coming back. And so there's really a sense right now that in many rural areas that there needs to be efforts made for those communities to be sustainable into the future. And so it is a matter of trying to, and then there's also a factor of that shift from farm-based jobs to non-farm-based jobs, and because of consolidation in agriculture industries over the years, there are and technology improvements that have, you know, led to fewer need for employees on farms. There's just less job opportunities that are farm-based in these rural communities. And so there's a shift that's going on and trying to be able to sustain those communities with non-farm-based jobs is important. So that sort of provides the context. And,
okay.
And there are a number of studies done at the federal government level and by others as well that sort of show the challenges facing rural communities.
Vice Chair McKeown.
And I just might add very briefly that you could substitute in our state the word agriculture for natural resource-based.
Yes.
Because in a lot of our communities it has to do with a shift in policies that have impacted natural resource-based economies rather than agricultural economies. But you're going to see both, but that's kind of a shift you could make in our part of the world.
Yep, absolutely. And I appreciate that. And actually, I appreciate the comment because, as a point of clarification, when I'm talking about agritourism, there are some of the more traditional things that you might think of in terms of agritourism, about bringing people on to tour farms and to see working ranches and things like that. But there are also some other industries that sort of cross over in terms of that also address the natural resources tourism areas as well. So
thank you.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I think it just helps to a little context anyway, we're working towards here.
Absolutely. So taking a look then again at some of these states that have sort of created comprehensive policies to promote agritourism, in the past 15 years or so, we've seen several states such as Indiana, Vermont, and Kentucky pursue these types of approaches. And there are some common elements that can be found. And again, that's not to say that all these states that have comprehensive approaches are following the exact same model. But as a general rule, there are some commonalities that come out when looking at these state laws and programs. First, many states have started their comprehensive approaches by forming working groups or task forces to study rural tourism in the state and to identify a path forward. For example, in Kentucky, they created an agritourism working group to begin exploring ways to, quote, improve and promote the viability of a statewide agritourism industry sector. Indiana, Tennessee, and other states have taken a similar first step. Working group members usually include members of state agencies, such as representatives from the Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources, Tourism, or Economic Development, and others, and then also members of local or regional organizations, and then, of course, agritourism operators themselves. Once created, these working groups usually start by doing an inventory of what agritourism operations are currently out there in the states, and then after they do that, they work towards identifying issues and obstacles faced by those operators and by others that might be trying to enter the market. So these studies lay the groundwork for developing a plan for moving forward to promote and expand agritourism in the state. And this is usually when the state legislatures get a little bit more involved. Oftentimes, the working groups will have several recommendations for additional legislative action. For example, in Indiana, after they did their initial studies, they came back and the legislature passed a law that did two primary things to promote the industry. One is that it created some permanent agritourism spots in or positions on the Indiana Tourism Council, just so that viewpoint was represented in their deliberations. And then also it called for the development and adoption of a statewide agritourism plan. And so that's, again, the idea of adopting a statewide agritourism plan is something that we've seen other states pursue as well. And in general, these plans set strategies for marketing and promotional activities, for public relations and outreach, training and certification programs for agritourism owners and employees, and partnerships with local and regional organizations. So these plans help to coordinate the activities among the state agencies and between the state and local levels of government. And I'd be happy to provide any examples of some of these statewide plans if the committee would be interested in seeing those after my presentation. So now I'd like to shift and talk a little bit about some of the individual policies that make up, in some cases, the overall agriculture plans in states that have comprehensive policies. And in those states that don't, you know, the states have nonetheless adopted some of these programs. So the first one I want to talk about is something that we've seen in almost 20 states, laws that limit the liability of agritourism operators in the states. And I wanted to take a few moments to go through these types of laws, because I know it's an issue. I understand that it's an issue that Oregon may be, this legislature may be considering in the near future. So for the most part, these types of laws limit civil liability arising from injuries caused by inherent risks associated with activities at agricultural tourism facilities. So these activities generally are defined to include farming or ranching activities, viewing historic, cultural, or natural attractions, harvest your own activities, or animal exhibitions. Usually, roadside produce stands and the retail sale of merchandise or food are not included in these liability exemption laws. The inherent risks covered by these laws include unpredictable animal behavior, natural conditions of the land, ordinary dangers of farm equipment and facilities, and the potential for a participant to act in a negligent way. In order for the operators to avoid liability, usually these laws require that they post signs warning of the potential dangers of visiting an agriculture or ranching or other operation, and so that people are well warned. And then, of course, it's not a blanket liability. Owners still have to have a duty of care that they need to do in order to ameliorate or fix any obstacles or potential dangers that they know of and things like that. It's definitely not a blanket liability, but it's something that because in many cases agritourism facilities are starting on or are part of an operation that is currently existing for other purposes. Farms or something like that. That's why, but...
Interesting because I think in Oregon we have some ways to get liability protection, but I think they all involve you not being able to charge.
Uh-huh.
I think that's, if I remember right, our habitat access program, I think that's the whole deal. You don't charge and you let people on your property, then we do it, but that's not really the point then of making more income in a rural area.
Yes.
And these are more, I don't know if it's just forest land, but my father-in-law, when we talked a little bit about you pick orchards, he's like, I don't want people running around out here. What if they get hurt?
Yeah. And this
that was the end of that right there.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why some states have pursued these laws as a way to sort of allow people to, if they want to host a UPIC operation, that they might be able to do it without fear of being exposed to civil liability. Mm-hmm. So that's one area that, again, we've seen almost 20 states adopt those types of laws. And they tend to be fairly similar. The warning requirements and things change, but they also tend to be fairly similar. Another sort of hot topic that we've seen is the cottage food industry.
Yeah, we did this. One of my former colleagues who isn't here liked to call it hippies making stuff in their bathtubs. He was a no. The rest of it passed. It's a law, but
So you guys have a similar law, so I won't spend a lot of time on this, but it is an element that we've seen in a lot of states in terms of allowing some people to send or sell food directly to consumers from their farms or their own kitchens.
We called it Farm Direct or something, but it was a cottage industry law, yeah.
Yep. And again, we've seen quite a few states. In fact, just in this year, we've seen four additional states pass.
Have you heard of anybody getting sick in these small? I haven't.
You know, actually, I have talked to some environmental health professionals, and they do say that they have seen it. I know that it's a concern for environmental health professionals, some of these laws, and there's a sense that maybe they're exposing the risk potential.
The challenge is getting facts. So, like, right after ours passed, there was a lady out in Bend who got botulism, and I got a call immediately because I was the author of the law. I get a call immediately. Well, you know, what about this? And then we waited a day. That was her own canning. She botulized herself, whatever the word is. Yeah, it had nothing to do with buying at a farmer's market or anything else. So, but sometimes you gotta chase these things down.
Yes.
Turns out.
And a lot of the laws limit the types of foods that can be sold to those that are
botulized.
Low risk.
It's not a word.
Low risk, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that's what we did. We had a pH balance, and then if it were low enough, you put a label on there saying this was made in a home kitchen and let the buyer beware kind of deal.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a few other laws that I'll or policies and programs that I just want to highlight for you. One is, again, with the idea that a lot of times the farms or ranches or whatever are created for other purposes. Sometimes states come through and say, in addition to exempting or creating exceptions for liability, also for compliance with building standards. So Maryland passed a law that said, if you are a farm and it's not, and agritourism isn't your primary purpose, then certain agricultural facilities don't have to follow the state building codes with regards to the number of bathrooms that would normally be required in a business or sprinkler systems and things like that. So those are other exceptions that we've seen. Another one is application of local laws. There are some states that are encouraging a potential obstacle that states have addressed relates to local laws and ordinances that might impose other requirements that limit the ability of agritourism operators in the states. So again, in addition to building codes, there could also be zoning laws or health and safety requirements or noise ordinances.
Definitely in Oregon. We passed something last time. We're, I think, going to see how we did two. Senate Bill 960 and 11, and then we followed up with 11, and then 13 was for just winery-related things to try and allow, you know, some more events and activities, because we're pretty tight on the land use side here in Oregon, of course. But we did open it up some more here.
Okay.
To see how it's going. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, so it's the similar type of thing in terms of encouraging that. In Virginia, they had a law where the state prohibited local regulation of usual and customary agritourism activities at wineries unless there was a substantial impact on the health, safety, or welfare. And so in North Carolina, they had a statute that authorized cities to amend ordinances applicable to its planning jurisdiction to provide quote-unquote flexibility to farming operations.
Our state system is probably more restrictive than our municipalities and counties.
Is that
here,
right?
I would say. I think. It depends on what counties, what cities, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. So moving right along, another approach is to provide certain tax exemptions for agritourism businesses. And again, this is usually a matter of where the income from agritourism, the agritourism side of the operation, is considered supplemental or incidental to the overall agricultural purpose of the farm or the ranch or the other resource, natural resource-based activity. But again, it would provide an exemption. South Carolina is one example of where they've allowed these types of operations to have an exemption from certain taxes. Again, many states have state promotional websites that promote the agritourism industry, and they serve a couple of purposes. One is to provide just an inventory of the number of agritourism operations that there are in a state, and then also to promote those operations to the national, to the state, national, and international audiences as well. And just as a note, there are some states that require the agritourism operations to register with the state, and in some cases pay a fee to be listed on the site. There's also, we've seen in some states as a way to promote agritourism, the already existing agritourism industries, they've passed laws that establish a program whereby once a registered agritourism operation is registered with the state, they pay a fee to the Department of Transportation, and the Department of Transportation will put up signs on highways and major roads directing traffic to those agritourism facilities. And it's usually the cost of maintenance, usually of the original installation and then long-term maintenance, usually falls on the agritourism operator, and so there's annual fees that are associated with that. We've seen that in Alabama and Georgia are a couple states that have pursued that policy. And then finally, we, of course, see grants that states make to local development districts or local agencies to help promote the agritourism industry. One example is in Pennsylvania, where by statute they created a program that authorizes funding to local development districts for, quote, the development of a regional tourism brochure and map designating the historic sites and tourist attractions within the region. And so those are again, that's not a totally comprehensive overview of all the different types of ways that states have promoted agritourism, but there are just a few of the either areas where a number of states have pursued similar policies or are issues that are being considered in states right now. So I know I don't have a lot of time left here today, but I did want to briefly talk about some other areas that aren't just specific to agritourism, but just some overall trends that we're seeing with regards to state economic development policy. And I in particular wanted to point out a couple of approaches. One is efforts to develop entrepreneurial or entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial businesses in rural areas. And then secondly, the idea of supporting clusters, which I'll talk about here in a second. So in terms of supporting entrepreneurship, this is an important issue. Again, I had mentioned before that the economies of the rural areas are changing from farm-based jobs to non-farm-based jobs. And with that, there's a sense, there's a feeling that people need to really support the service-based industries and the technology-dependent industries. And so one way to do that is to help promote entrepreneurship in the rural areas. And so we're seeing... I did want to mention that according to the National Commission on Entrepreneurship, entrepreneurs create 600,000 to 800,000 businesses annually. And so it is, again, an important issue to do. States can support entrepreneurship by providing access to seed capital, developing local ability to identify, encourage, and train entrepreneurs, and by using online networks and other technology to connect entrepreneurs with critical resources and information. So a few examples. In Nebraska, they passed a Building Enterprise Communities Act, which aimed to create community capacity to generate and retain wealth. The act created a funding mechanism that provided grants to local communities to help support entrepreneurial development programs in those communities. And just as background, the grants were up for up to 2 years and were for $25,000 was the max on that. And then they also developed an EDGE program, which it standard for Enhancing Developing and Growing Entrepreneurs, that provided customized training programs for local areas based on their own, those local areas' needs and abilities. In Kansas, they had a rural enterprise facilitation program that created community networks to support entrepreneurial business development. That program set up volunteer boards of local residents, and then those boards would hire a local facilitator to be an informational resource for would-be entrepreneurs.
That's Kansas?
Yeah, in Kansas, yep. As well as existing businesses. And the state used their federal community development block grant money to help cover about two-thirds of the cost of this program, which was overall about $1.5 million. In North Carolina, they have a rural economic development center. North Carolina is a state that's done a lot on rural economic development. They have their own state agency that really focuses on this and have provided quite a few resources to help spur economic development in rural areas in North Carolina. But their center established an institute for rural entrepreneurship to support the development of small and medium-sized businesses in rural areas. Since its creation, the program has created a comprehensive entrepreneurship development system and trained hundreds of local leaders in entrepreneurship and created and distributed business development tools to rural communities as well.
You know, not to put you on the spot too much, but
yeah.
North Carolina, do they have either, have they been going long enough to show results, or do they have metrics that show, you know, like the unemployment rates in rural areas versus urban areas are not as wide in areas they're working in as, you know, typically, which is usually quite a gap.
Yeah, Chairman Clem, thanks for the question. I do. They really started their work between 10 and 15 years ago, really started to focus on this. And so I do think that they have some metrics and would have some. I don't have any of those numbers right off of that. But because of they've done so much, I think they probably do have some of the results categorized or tracked anyway. And again, in North Carolina, these types of programs are supported by appropriations from the state and using, again, federal community development block grants. And then they also are teaming up with foundations and community colleges to help support those programs. The other quick issue that I wanted to mention is the idea of clusters, and clusters are regions that have interconnected businesses that collaborate together, and usually they're sector-based. The states can support clusters by encouraging the development of industry networks to provide a channel for businesses to work together. States can also ensure that cluster communities have access to capital and technical resources, and often because clusters require highly skilled workers, they are formed around existing universities or colleges or technical schools. So I'll just point out quickly, in Pennsylvania, they have established what's called a Keystone Innovation Zones program, and the idea behind this is to foster innovation and create opportunities through partnerships with educational institutions, private businesses, and private business support organizations, as well as commercial lending institutions and venture capital networks. So the state supports these this program through grants that can be used to coordination, strategic planning, personnel costs, hiring of consultants, and administration. And these grants can go up to $250,000, but they do require a 50-50 cash match by the local community. And then also, I just mentioned in Minnesota, they have a number of different clusters that have popped up in rural areas. For example, there's a wireless technology cluster in one area of the state, recreational transportation equipment manufacturing, in other words, making snowmobiles mostly and ATVs as well in another part of the state. But in order to support these clusters, the state department has partnered with the system of Minnesota universities and colleges to help develop classroom programs and other classroom efforts with the universities in order to train local workers. So that I'll conclude my comments there. Again, I'm happy to provide additional information to the committee should you request it, and I'm happy to answer any questions. And before I finish my comments, I'm going to really quickly mention that NCSL does have an agriculture task force that addresses not only agriculture but rural development issues, and you know, we are always happy to have legislators who are interested in these issues serving on our task force. So
What about, maybe it's not something you guys have categorized, but what about broadband accessibility, rural broadband initiatives?
That's something that is essential in many areas to connecting rural residents with jobs, because there are a lot of jobs that are supported or even just are completely reliant on broadband access through the internet. It's an area where the federal government has done a lot of work, and there is quite a bit. I don't know the exact percentage of rural areas that now have access to broadband technology, but it has grown significantly in the last 5 or 7 years, and I'd be happy to get the exact number, but it's well above 75% now, I think. So.
Yeah, I know. I serve on a broadband advisory council here in Oregon, and we're doing mapping and, you know, this kind of stuff. But my sense is, and, you know, you would know better probably, Representative McKeown, because she's got a fairly rural district. But, you know, my brother, who lives, one of her constituents, lives in a medium-sized town for Oregon, but small otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And he works for like some Belgian company, and he just sits in his his home office and supports IT, global plastics injection manufacturing IT support around the world from his slippers. And, makes a lot of money. He does quite well. And then my dad got a HughesNet rural something grant to get a high-speed internet deal, and he lives way out in the middle of the country with no neighbors, and he's got broadband through the satellite, basically. So it's, you know, in my own personal experience, seems like it's going better, but that's anecdotal, so that's what I don't know. Vice Chair McKeown.
Oh, Chair Clem, I'm just sitting here listening to this, and we have some structure in place with the community college and workforce development system that we have in place, which also partners in our rural communities with our small business development folks.
Mm-hmm.
We just put a chunk of money to increase the funding for the small business development operations that we have statewide. They have business incubators,
mm-hmm.
And they're connected with the community college and workforce development folks. You can come in and start any kind of business you want with support from the small business development folks, but I don't think there's ever been an emphasis on the, quote, agri-tourism component. So, I mean, we have a structure, and we have some funding, and OBDD does some seed money for business startups. So I think we have a framework. I'm just not sure the emphasis has ever been on this particular aspect of how we can improve job opportunities in rural communities. So,
well, we'll probably hear more about agritourism from our Travel Oregon experts, chief strategy officer, and in a moment here. But I do think, you know, generally speaking, what I experienced was the people who own the travel-related businesses are doing better. The people who work there are not making much money, and so you get into this whole thing where it's not the total solution, but it is pretty few people own the shops,
right,
and own the tourism related activities. Then you got to think about these other things: rural broadband clusters, developing businesses unrelated to more service level, mm-hmm. service economy type jobs, and getting, you know, rural manufacturing going, because the cost of land in urban areas and you know, utilities and things is so high, people want to Facebook will locate or Google will locate out in the Dalles because they found a good situation for energy costs and land costs and things like that. But I never thought of as a total solution, I don't think, by most of us, that tourism is going to save rural areas. If it adds to an individual operator's cash supply, that's great. But you want some other stuff going as well, I think, which is why you've got these other points, I think, mm-hmm. about entrepreneurs in particular.
Yep.
We have a thing here called the I don't know what it's called. We call it economic gardening, but there's another name now for the council, and that's one of the things. We don't fund it very well yet, but that's one of the things they're trying to do, is figure out how to have the state use these SDBC centers and really target entrepreneurial people, who that's their kind of mindset and their interest in life, and
mm-hmm.
capture them, you know, get them interested in information and resources, not have them leave, go to other states, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm just a comment's coming to my mind. In my community, to do something like you are proposing, I think, has merit. They are generally not great paying jobs, as you said, but you have to have an industry there to go look at. So if you don't have an agricultural base or a fishing industry or a timber industry or something that you can go look at, it kind of defeats the purpose.
Right, then you're just left with the beach only.
Right.
And there's not, I mean, we don't really want people setting up little shanty massage things on the
so
beach.
So there's a chicken or an egg thing here going on, too, for our rural communities. Yeah. So you got to have something to go look at.
Yeah. Selling trinkets on the beach, that's not our thing here.
Yeah. But I appreciate your comments, and I think there's some, you know, some opportunity to connect up with the framework we already have.
You'd rather be at the dentist?
To focus.
Yep.
Focus on energy, yeah.
I had a tooth pulled. I got to get it checked. We got a dental excused.
It was supposed to mean a date.
Yeah, I know, I was busy shaving. I know it's cancer, no shave in November. I know. Okay, so thank you. We'll, if you stay, we might want to banter a little more.
Yes. Over here. Can you help me find my... Thank you, Chair Clem. Scott West, Chief Strategy Officer with Travel Oregon, and interesting conversation this morning. I'm a rural kid from Oregon. Grew up in Echo.
Yeah.
Family's had a ranch out there for 120 years, so grew up baling hay and driving truck and stuff, but also from Coos Bay. So I grew up in Coos Bay with a couple of members here on our council here.
Did you go to Marshfield?
Marshfield graduate, 1975.
Once a pirate, always a pirate.
Oh, pirate, yeah. Yeah.
You
yeah,
and the audience will learn that all roads eventually come
they
through
do
Coos
come
Bay
through
at some
Coos
point.
Bay.
There's only one legislator here who's not a Marshfield graduate.
Yeah, I think. Anyway,
just for everybody.
And an adjacent county.
From anyway.
LeGrand High School, a
go.
Rural community.
There you go.
All right.
So... and now reside in the metropolis of Milwaukee, Oregon, as mentioned earlier. Interesting, just side comment that our family's, the ranch of our family, we have about 5,000 acres just outside of Echo up the Umatilla River. I've been there, had it for about 120 years, and still there, still farming. The interesting thing about the town's about 400 people. The town nearly dead. I mean, there was a restaurant and the gas station and the grocery store and all that went away. Interestingly enough, what's brought it back, if you've been through Echo, Oregon, over the course of the last year or two, is the winery. The winery that's going out on former ag ground, out on alfalfa ground now, is going, 50, 60, 100 acres of grapes, but they're actually building a winery in town that's brought that back. And the other part is recreation out through those Alkali Canyons, a bunch of great mountain biking, off-road cycling. And so the combination of what we've talked about here a little bit about recreation and a little different spin on ag or culinary is what's giving breath back into this little downtown. You go back to the historic district, all very cool, but it's all coming back based on different kind of agriculture and different kind of industry. So anyway, great comments earlier from Scott. A lot of the things that we certainly work on here. Just as a reminder, tourism in Oregon is $9.2 billion. It employs about 91,000 Oregonians, largest traded sector employer in the state, $2.2 billion in earnings, $380 million in taxation. Top four or five in the gross state product, but when you get into rural Oregon, it's in the top three. So, as mentioned earlier, it becomes a bigger factor. The further away you get from urban areas, it's a bigger factor as a contributing factor to the success of the. Our vision, Travel Oregon, is to better life through Oregonians through a strong local economy. So you don't hear tourism in there anywhere. It's we want strong local economies, and we believe that tourism should play its appropriate role. And for what we do, which is we market, we sell, we research, we develop. All of those things we think play to the rural economy in some way, and yet some of them more direct. So another day we can talk about everything. I know I'll talk just quickly here about a couple of things. I want to show a short little video of a community where some development has taken place, and I think when you hear from folks actually in the community speaking about what it's meant to their community, I think that's very powerful. In our marketing program, we focus on culinary and we focus on outdoor recreation. Kind of in the spring, we focus on outdoor recreation, and in the fall, we focus on the culinary product. And both outdoor recreation and culinary ag tourism, those are very strong in rural economies, as they are in urban ones too, to some degree, but very strong in rural economies.
We also, in our marketing program, to get to specifically to regional outreach, we have a regional cooperative marketing program that was built into the statutes then when Travel Oregon was turned into a semi-independent agency back in 2003. Part of that was an allowance for the commission to approve a regional cooperative marketing program, which allowed up to 15% of Travel Oregon's proceeds or revenues, which come from a 1% statewide lodging tax. Those resources then go back out to the seven tourism regions on a pro rata basis. So in the last year, about $1.5 million. In the year we're in right now, $1.5 million will be distributed out through the state, and next year, $1.6 million. So those get back into, those are used for incremental business out of state or internationally. So it's not money that comes to regional areas or urban rural areas and then is used to just move business around Oregon. It's actually used to go outside of the state or internationally. And our sales department, the sales efforts, travel trade group in the U.S., which is bus traffic, bus groups, both in the U.S. and Canada, and then we also all in the international markets in Asia, China being growing exponentially, will soon be the largest. Inbound in to the U.S. and certainly into Oregon. But we're also in Europe. We're also in Oceania, down in Australia and New Zealand, and also in kind of emerging markets in Brazil and in India. Both of those are coming very strongly.
Did you meet any of the Taiwanese tour operators who were here by any chance? About two weeks ago?
I did not, but they did come to our office, and Todd, our CEO, who I think was with your mission to Taiwan, then we met with them down at in downtown and came to the office.
That's pretty neat. Yeah. So this was a deal where Travel Oregon helped bring some of the biggest tour operators, and they're pretty big. These groups were quite big, and Delta Airlines was involved in Taiwan. And they were getting ready to come here to learn more about how to, well, enjoy themselves, I think, and then learn how to sell the packages. And they were just getting ready to leave, and this was like kind of the kickoff dinner. But it was quite an impressive event, I think, for, you know, that's what you got to do. You got to find those kind of people who want to make money along with what we're doing, promoting ourselves. They're, you know, going to make some markup on their packages. Good, that's fine. And they were getting ready to come to Oregon, and I forget where all they were going, but it was a pretty neat agenda. Phil McTeese Factory, a bunch of places.
Chair Clem, yeah, the interesting thing about a lot of the international inbound travel is the rural experience is certainly part of what they're really looking for. We've got great partners in the room. Port of Portland, great partner. Delta Airlines, great partner. The state, certainly, and some of the Travel Portland, all good, really strong partners in those international markets. And
because they all live in a big city. They've seen real big cities.
Right.
They sort of know what that deal is, but they've not really seen something like Mount Hood, really, or Crater Lake or anything.
That's correct. And typically, Oregon is sort of a secondary, tertiary market from the international. From the international base, typically to L.A., San Francisco, Vegas, New York. But Oregon has a real rural experience that is sought, especially in the European markets, but also in the Asian markets too. So, really strong play there. In the research, it's our website. This is the industry side of our website, and this is sort of as if you're an industry member coming to this, kind of how it's organized, and I'll get to it in just a second. But the research, we do all sorts of economic impact research, we do visitor profile research, and we try to localize that research as much as we can. So the research gets as granular as it possibly can, so folks in the counties, no matter where they are in Oregon, are able to take that, analyze it, and understand who the customers are, what they like doing, and where they're coming from, how long they're staying, how much they're spending. So we try to get that information back down to as local a space as we possibly can. We also, I think, in one of the big wins over the last year is we initiated with the partners the first of its kind bicycle tourism economic impact study, and found that about $400 million worth of spend comes from cyclists into the state of Oregon, and then we were able to break that out by county. And those are intentional cyclists coming here to spend money, and what that's done is certainly surface now as an aggregator of conversation around trying to connect some of these routes regionally, so folks, giving folks product when they come to Oregon to cycle. And then lastly, I'll just talk really quickly about our development program. One of the things that Travel Oregon does, which is fairly unique in the tourism space, is actually has a development program. Most programs across the country are certainly marketing-based and certainly sales-based. Very few of them actually have a development program. We think it's absolutely essential that on the ground, working with the partners that were already discussed here today, small business, our small business folks at the community colleges, with our other friends in economic development, with foundations, on how we can participate and support in those local conversations. Again, I talked a little bit about the bicycling work. That work around the research has really helped implement and start that conversation. Oregon also, in this cycling arena, is the first that has a scenic bikeway program. There's about 10 of them now, Travel Oregon, in concert with Oregon State Parks, put together a series of the best of the best, and these are promoted through all of our consumer channels, but they are almost entirely all in rural Oregon, and it's a way to create sort of cycles, you know, routes of commerce for folks. We have a bunch of videos here. I can suggest you can go take a look at those when you have the opportunity, but there's that work is going on also.
Just a comment, if I may.
I know that we're talking about a couple different things here,
and certainly, you know, economic development in rural communities is important, you know, so we can maintain some sort of population in our rural areas and a way of life, I suppose, without growing too much. Otherwise, it wouldn't be rural anymore. But the tourism piece is a little bit of a different apple, I think, than, you know, strictly the economic development, and takes a different kind of thought process and investment in the type of infrastructure. We've been working on a project in my district for quite some time around the bicycles and the winery tourism. And, you know, there's a lot of challenges in the rural areas with, you know, a safe roadway to ride a bike on. You know, we have truckers out in those rural areas with log trucks, and, you know, there's a lot of issues. And so I'm kind of curious, when you're talking about these programs, are you, you know, able to work with ODOT to help to prioritize some of those safety issues to enable growth in that sort of rural tourism? Because those are major, you know, sort of infrastructure investments that need to be made to, if you're going to see much growth in that sort of, tourism venue.
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, couldn't agree with you more. The scenic bikeway program that I spoke of is a very highly regulated process. I mean, it takes a community group of folks go ride that. They grade it as a community support group. And if the route is not safe, it will not surface as a scenic bikeway. So safety is foremost in mind in all of these. The other interesting thing around in the cycling community and the cycling opportunity is the cyclists you see on the roads are the cyclists you see. There's ever bit as many of those and more that are cycling off-road. And the real opportunities in the long term, when you match up the natural resource areas that are now taken out of, to some degree, that have been removed from production in the timber arena, you know, in public lands that we have, and you look at some of the logging roads and you look at some of the ancillary roads that are in those spaces, the opportunity to be off-road, provide opportunity for folks to cycle in those spaces, there's an enormous opportunity in this state to do just that. The question always becomes around how do you use these public, either Forest Service or BLM lands that may have allowed recreation of some sort, but then to some degree connect those through different kinds of public lands, and also whether they make sense or not in those spaces. But right now, there was down in Yahats this last, you know, a couple months ago, there was a road ride for the first time called the Gravel Epic. First time event, 130, 140 folks down that road all up through Forest Service land, and brought those folks down there for a couple of days. So when you look at those multi-uses, let's just talk about the Willamette Valley, like I think you were speaking to, or in the valley to some degree, the uses around ag, the uses around just general transportation, and then the uses around recreation, there is tension in that space. And from our perspective, we're not going to promote those kinds of things that put folks, we don't want cyclists in harm's way, and we want that kind of use to be measured and appropriate, and that all users are involved in that conversation. We want to invite them to places where they're not going to have a good experience, mm-hmm. and put them at risk.
How do you prevent it, though? I mean, you don't want to put them there, because I think I've found that, you know, as wineries pop up in our
foothills where we have a lot of logging operations going on. The cyclists go there regardless of whether you designated a cyclist road or not. And so I just think there's a lot of challenges and a lot of infrastructure that needs attention, and I don't know how you get those sorts of priorities in front of the Transportation Commission to think that's more important than, you know, building a bridge.
Chair Clem, Representative Holby, don't disagree, and I think that what you've seen is there's some transitions in the funding to allow some more infrastructure in that space, pedestrian, cycling, more discretion for ODOT's, I think, in the last session. I think there was some move. I can't remember the exact name of the. Yeah. Can't recall that, but I do know that there was some money moved in that space. And I will tell you from our perspective, from the tourism, we're not interested in developing and offering and inviting folks to participate in places where they're not going to be safe. The other part of that, however, is also there's consumer awareness, there's signage issues, there's things where you can create space where folks will anticipate that they're going to be more than just themselves on the road, that there may be cyclists or other kinds of use on that too, that I think there are some places in the state that could use that in addition to what's going on now.
All right. How are we doing on your...
I'm fine. I'm doing fine.
Yeah.
How are you guys doing? I know we're right. I have a video I can show you. It's at the City of Oak Ridge. I actually think it's pretty powerful.
Video.
If you'd like to see that, I can close with that. I think it's interesting to hear from the folks in their own voices.
Yeah, let's watch it.
7 minutes. If you want me to do it, we will. If not, we'll come back.
Let's watch it.
Thanks.
And now that she's not here, well, how about Elkton? You've been through Elkton many times growing up. It's pretty cool now. They've got a lot of interesting stuff going on there.
There's a lot of cool stuff in a lot of the local communities. And one of the great things about my job, although I work, we have an office in Portland, and as I get around the state to these things, there's lots of really interesting things going on in lots of rural communities that we really need to share. I'll be at the University of Oregon tomorrow with the Folklife Network that really is illuminating a lot of very cool folk art, folk stuff that's going on around the state that we hope to put into our conversation channels with consumers. We have a rural tourism studio program, much like what Scott talked about earlier, a very intensive program. We're working down on the Wild Rivers Coast right now, Bandon, Port Orford, Gold Beach, and Brookings, along with Bandon Dunes, money coming off of their Par 3, the preserve, that money, all those resources go to a foundation. Some of those resources are going into some economic development, sustainable development, business development, and also tourism development on the South Coast. So we're working down there now. We've worked in Wallowa County, Oak Ridge, River Canyon Country, John Day Country. This is a piece of our intensive work in Oak Ridge, and it talks about what's gone on in a small timber-based economy and what's happening over the last couple of years. So I'll close with that, if that's okay. Let me find air.
What makes rural Oregon so unique is every town has their own little story to tell. You know, our story started out years ago with the railroad and timber, but timber's not around anymore.
There was a lull and a period of, what do we do now?
Oak Ridge was a sleepy, dead town and not a lot going on.
As we're struggling, you know, with the timber declines, we got to find something.
That's the challenge, is how do you reinvent yourself and still pay respect to your past.
We had all the players come to the same table. We had the Forest Service, we had the city, we had Travel Oregon and Travel Lane County and local advocates come together and say, what do you want? What does Oak Ridge want? And a lot of smart people said, hey, you know what? You got something going. Run with it. Hell yeah, I just got paid. It's time to get this started. Your friends keep enemies at bay. Forget that I was there for you.
Right now in Oak Ridge, tourism is really important because we don't have a lot of industry. People figured out that, oh, well, let's use the natural assets of the community. There are things that we know how to do, that we like to do, that we could share with others, and so let's invite them here to do those things.
During the Rural Tourism Studio, we developed this idea that we have to improve customer service, and we came up with the idea of We Speak. We speak biking, we speak wildflowers, what people are looking for, what are the questions tourists are asking.
The goal of the We Speak program is to train the local community in topics that they're passionate about, so then they can convey that to the tourists.
My name is Heather, and I speak Oak Ridge camping.
Sticking around camping, or
my name is Trisha, and I speak rivers and lakes.
I'm Richard, and I speak wildflowers.
When the visitor and the trained frontline staff have an interaction, and the visitor comes away excited about their stay here, that is the goal.
We invited some friends out from Eugene, and they all happened to be members of a ukulele band. And they said, why don't you have a ukulele festival? And we go, what? What an odd idea. And once we got started, there was a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of energy behind it. You know, the ukulele is just like a fun, positive little instrument, something that people can pick up casually and then they start getting into it.
Music is a huge community builder, especially in this small town. I think the ukulele festival is doing a great job in helping to reinvigorate the economy here in Oak Ridge.
You haven't lived until you see 40 ukuleles playing Rolling Stones music.
You know, it's always fun to go to a little tiny community and find something really fabulous.
Mountain Bike Oregon to me is about community. It's about the mountain bike community and giving back to the Oak Ridge community. We got the Ride Center money, which is $400,000 to do trail development, signage, and other stuff in this area.
We basically have a plan to develop 5 major trailheads around the community, like spokes in a hub. The community becomes the trailhead, and that's sort of the Ride Center concept for us.
That we got that money shows that we're committed to it and that also others believe in what we're doing up here.
I'm not a real religious guy, but this is where I come for my experiences. This is where I want to be.
I think some of the challenges you face in a rural community are the same no matter where you go. But I think every year it gets better around here. Like I always say about anything, including tourism, it's not the end-all be-all. It's not going to save the town alone, but if you don't think it makes an impact, you're lying to yourself.
The rural environment and the rural economy, everything's just a little bit more challenging. There aren't as many resources, and so you have to think about how can I leverage what I am doing to really multiply my effect.
Tribal Oregon's been a huge asset to Oak Ridge. They've helped us get funding, written letters of support, and we couldn't have done it by ourselves. We needed that professional assistance. But most of all, they keep coming back. They make sure that we're doing okay. They keep checking back.
Figure out something that's unique to your community. Know what you have. You need to own it. It needs to be something that really matters to your community.
It feels good to not be, Oak Ridge, that, dead logging town that nobody wants to go to. It's like, yeah, I'm from Oak Ridge, and it's beautiful here, and you should come and check it out.
Thanks. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
You all right? You missed the Union Pub.
What's that?
I said you missed the Union Pub in Oak Ridge.
It was on the opening shot. That was the chair.
Oh, that was?
I never missed the Union Pub. Okay. Okay.
I don't either. That's right. I guess I missed it there.
Yeah.
Good? Okay. Now, Scott, did you used to ref soccer?
Pardon me?
Did you used to referee soccer?
I think when I was going to high school, I'm not sure there was even soccer. I'm not quite sure. Certainly at Marshall there wasn't.
I've got a recollection of a Scott West, but I was a pretty little guy, and you were pretty tall if it was you.
I was a football and basketball player. So, anyway.
Maybe I just watched you when I was a kid.
It might have happened, and now you're watching me again.
That's pretty cool. I was texting my mom. I was trying to get a bio. Like, what do you do?
No, I know your mom.
Yeah.
My folks are both teachers.
Is that right? Sorry. Anyway.
Yeah.
We'll talk in the hall later.
I know my folks. I know my folks know you.
Yeah, so, that's right.
Anyway, thank you for the time.
Thank you. This is great. Yeah, we really had fun. Now, okay, LIDs. Favorite topic this interim. Come on up, Dave and Aaron. My mom doesn't know how to use text messages, apparently. She's like trying to call me. I'm like, I'm in a meeting. Can you just answer?
Just try FaceTime.
Do you recognize him? Yeah. Okay. So I'm trying to tell her to leave me alone. Okay. So.
You ready, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, my mom. I'm trying to get her to text me. She keeps trying to call me instead.
Oh.
I said, I'm in a meeting. Can you text? And then she calls again. It's not good. So, anyway, welcome.
Welcome.
Well, let's talk a little bit about recent events. So, as the massive amount of committee members know, we've heard a little bit about the LID situation. Mr. Honeycutt came up with a couple ideas. He threw those out. We got some responses, some challenges maybe with the way they're, you know, initial thoughts. And then there was a meeting day or two ago, and we think we have maybe a way to move forward about work groupish kind of activities over the next few weeks. Or lay out for me what we've got.
Chair Clam, Representative Holvey.
Committee.
Yeah, subcommittee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. Ms. Doyle and I met with Beth on Tuesday to talk about where we are. As the two of you know, this is an issue that was we had a meeting an informational meeting right towards the end of the session on this.
Yeah.
There was a bill last session that dealt with this with a fee in lieu of an LID up in the Dalles. After the informational hearing, there was some discussion, I know, with the chair about putting some sideboards on local improvement districts, and essentially the statutes at this point are really bare bones and give the cities the ability to essentially design their own process for a local improvement district. And the idea that there be some sideboards with the goal of making sure that the property owner that was brought into the district, number one, received some benefits from being brought into the district, and number two, wasn't put in the position of essentially looking down the barrel of bankruptcy as a result of the of an assessment that, in the case of the Kaiser situation, was 20 times at the value of the property, a $6 million assessment on a $300,000 piece of property. So, Ms. Doyle and I have talked. I drafted a sort of a bare bones piece of legislation proposal that we could get as a stakeholder. We met with Beth on Tuesday, pared that back a little bit more to get something into Ledge Council by the deadline, and then we've made a commitment to each other and that we would meet again at least a couple more times to see if we can really focus and get something that we can present before the bill actually drops, so that we have a bill ready to go in the short session in February that doesn't need amendments, and it, hopefully we can have consensus on. And again, our goal with this process, and I hope the committee's goal, if the committee is interested in moving forward on this, is not to make LIDs an impossible task. They're a financing mechanism. They work most of the time. But really to hone in on those situations where the assessment is significant and puts a burden on the property owner, in many cases an unwilling property owner, someone who doesn't want to be in the be part of the district and doesn't have deep pockets, to keep those folks from having to lose their property because they can't pay the amount of the assessment. So that's our goal. I don't think it behooves the cities or anyone for a property owner in an LID to have their property go into foreclosure because they can't pay the assessment. So that's where we're going. I would hope that, and I asked Beth to ask you, Mr. Chair, if you could find a couple of maybe unwilling volunteers on the committee, twist a couple arms.
Representative Davis already agreed, especially if we can do the meetings in Portland.
Okay.
And since Representative Unger left, and I don't know why, he's now on it as well.
Oh, so, good.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
There's two.
Yeah, just a couple of folks that could sit down with the cities and us and see if we can come up with something that we can bring to you in February that doesn't have a whole lot of fight. We may not be able to kumbaya, but if we can get fairly close, at least we've made a lot of progress.
Yeah.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. Dave and I did meet, and we have made the commitment to work on this. We don't enjoy foreclosing on properties, but we do want to maintain the usefulness of the LID tool. We also recognize that there's a very different version of LIDs when you're dealing with under or undeveloped property versus, the neighborhood of 10 folks who want their sidewalks and their proper road. So we want to look at maybe setting up some thresholds to create that we hit before we have to go through a more rigorous process. But we do need to maintain that flexibility for local governments to figure out how LIDs work in their community and which is the best financing tool for particular projects, because we don't have a lot of financing tools. To give some background about how many cities use this, we do an annual survey on our finances for all of our cities, and of those that responded, just over 40%. Or just under 40% use LIDs. SDCs are a primary funding opportunity for infrastructure, but we can't use SDCs when it's a special benefit to a particular property. Mm-hmm. It's just not a tool that's available if we're, benefiting a select area. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that we maintain that tool, and it's also a tool for the developers as a way of finding financing and getting the work accomplished. So we want to protect that ability for the cities and private entities to work together to develop property using a financing tool that allows extended payments and a bond and things like that. And we don't want to jeopardize bond status based on state regulation either. That's something we need to consider in this process as well.
Yeah, the more we've talked about this for a while now, it does seem to come down to, in a project where if you had a vote, these are the people who voted no, then what are their rights? That seems to be where we're getting at. Like the developer, yeah, they want to use a bonding financing, good, promotes that. I mean, some people would argue the market, they can figure that out on their own, but I believe in economic development, some government assistance in that. So I think that part's good. It's when they pull in other people, what are their rights? And, the extreme is they don't get to pull in anybody else. There's no double majorities or triple majorities where no one else gets brought in other than the people who voluntarily want to. If that's unworkable, which it probably is, then, now what are these sideboards, particularly focusing in on the no, I don't really want in here, but someone else is telling me I'm going to be in here because you're going to get something out of it. Let's make sure we've got that kind of figured out.
Chair Clem, I understand that that's the focus of who we're trying to protect, and I think we can find ways that work to do that.
Yeah. How exciting that.
It's especially problematic when you get an assessment that's really high. If it's a $5,000 assessment for sidewalk improvements and you can spread the payments out over 15 years, well, for most people I think that's doable. Yeah. When it's $200,000 on a piece of property that may not be worth much more than that, if that, and it's spread out over 15 years, that's essentially a second mortgage. In some cases, a second mortgage that exceeds the value of the first mortgage. And you know,
especially if it's really not your plan to do anything with it anytime soon to recoup some of that gain, you got to rethink your plans then to do something, and you may not be in a position at that moment in your life with money or whatever else is going on to do something.
And if the infrastructure takes a long time to develop, you know, if the project takes a long time to complete, if there is some additional value as a result of the new infrastructure, that's fine.
The sequencing
but
issue,
it's the 10-year period of time when you're making payments that you can't make.
That's
that
interesting.
Creates the problem.
Yeah. And it seems like those costs to the infrastructure provider should be accruing at certain intervals. Not all at once, and probably not monthly, but we probably ask people to pay monthly, even if the person spending the money, sometimes the city might be, or the LID might be putting the money out more up front and getting it later. Sometimes they may be never putting anything in and just getting the money. And we're harmonizing that where it's more related, ideally, to the actual expenditure of money, their payments. I don't know if that's even procedurally possible.
Well, Derek Clem, I think part of the process is that there's a two steps in the assessment before the assessment becomes final. There's the initial assessment when we decide whether or not to deform the LID, and then there's the final assessment that it should only be completed after the work is done to determine what actual costs are, and therefore the assessment is based on real costs. So the costs should have been incurred already.
Then you get into this situation, okay, what about in Kaiser where they didn't even do anything and yet there's an assessment? They could probably win in court saying we didn't get the benefit, but then it's do you have money for the lawyer? And the city or the LID does because it's a staff attorney, and then the other people don't have money. They'll win, but they don't have money for the lawyer, so then they get into this, geez, what do I do here? Do I just give up? Do I really want to fight City Hall? Do I have a lawyer? And if we can figure out a way to make that less painful so it's not quite that, you know, David versus Goliath dynamic, that would be good. Because, I mean, it's an isolated circumstance, I know, but I've read a few others now where there's people who feel like, you know, the city's greater economic development good put me in a pinch here, and I'm not sure I have the resources to do much about it legally, so I'm calling you. I've been getting a few letters like that.
Yeah, well, the other side of that is I've also heard from cities who have instituted LIDs with the agreement of all participation, all participants are property owners, and they haven't been paid. And they haven't decided to foreclose in those instances, but they still have to pay off the Bancroft or the bonding that goes with it.
Yeah, right.
And they also, that means that everybody in the city is paying for the improvements to a particular property, that they're not receiving the benefit of that sidewalk. You know, maybe they walk down the street every once in a while, but the general populace is paying for it. So there has to be a happy medium.
Right, yeah. I mean, I'm particularly interested in the no vote, the people who don't want it. They don't really want the rest of the city. They don't want the improvement either. They're fine leaving it just like it was, but so they got sucked into some other project. That's where it's tough because the rest of the city's not benefiting. They're not benefiting. Some developers benefiting. You know, the economy's benefiting generally, hopefully, of the city if the project doesn't go bankrupt and leave everybody on the hook like they did in Kaiser. But, you know, it's not easy. That's why I know it's a little bit rushed, but I want to get something on the books here. Yeah. Anyway, I'm optimistic. I'm pleased. And since I'm going on vacation, I'll let those two gentlemen work with you during Christmas. Sorry about that.
Is that what we're paying for?
Not really. I'm not sorry, actually, at all. But I wanted to say that for your benefit. Because I got those annexation bills coming again. Maybe in February.
All right.
Okay, then. All right. Oh. Somebody's a no vote, I know. All right. Let's move on to new topics. Thank you for the update, and thank you for your meeting and and willingness to continue to talk. Okay,
yeah, Mr. Chair, issue of bankrupting, bankrupting has been around for decades and decades and decades, and so I hope we're not trying to fix an anomaly that may not really be caused by the system, you know, and changing things really dramatically. Right, I think there's an issue to be addressed, but, you know, I think we do need to be cautious about how we address that, because it traditionally has been a very good tool to get some improvements done for property owners who usually benefit from it, and generally, hopefully, they pay for it at some point. But anyway, just a word of caution about how much we do to that system.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think that's right. We don't want to wreck it. It's a little fine tuning, maybe. We'll see if we can earn a vote out of you. I don't know.
Fine tuning annexation too.
See if I can earn my first vote out of you this entire committee. We'll see.
Well, 2015's coming, you know, who knows?
Yeah, good. Okay. Representative Springer. Wait one moment.
I think she was.
You're Deke. Okay. So, Dick, where's Uri? Yeah, come on up, gentlemen. Yep. Unless she wants to.
Looked like she wanted to start it.
Well, that's, yeah, if she wants to, that's fine. We thought she didn't want to before, so let's. Okay, all right. So tell us a little bit about what's going on in this federal state arena. Why are you here? Why did I ask you to come here?
Committee?
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, for the record, Dick Peterson, Director of Department of Environmental Quality. First, I want to start out by thanking Representative Springer, Senator Close, and Senator Olson, who have taken an interest in a possible update to regulations related to fine particulate pollution, and for facilitating three group meetings with stakeholders, which have been both helpful and informative. I also want to thank you for inviting us here today, too. We're always happy to update you on DEQ programs, so hopefully that door stays open for us. Happy to do so. In way of background, DEQ implements the federal Title V industrial permitting program in Oregon. Title V is a section of the Clean Air Act, and then we issue permits to emit under Title V. DEQ is currently, responsibility as a delegated program, when there's a federal change, Oregon must update its rules to comport with federal changes. And that's to ensure that we're meeting those federal requirements and that we're protecting public health, and that we do it in a way that considers environmental viability. So we're currently working on a comprehensive update to our permitting rules and considering an update to some statewide standards related to fine particulate emissions as part of this comprehensive update. So it's important to keep in mind that we're still gathering information and that we have not yet proposed any rule amendments. But over the past couple of months, we have discussed draft concepts and conducted extensive outreach to get feedback before proposing rule amendments for formal public comment. And Representative Springer, Senator Close, and Senator Olson have convened us to have three group meetings with stakeholders to talk about some of these concepts. And we met, prior to that, we met with stakeholders throughout the state in August to get input on our proposal. This extra step is not required by DEQ, but we believe it's necessary to reach out and get input before we move forward with this type of rulemaking. And it'll certainly help us make informed decisions as far as moving forward. In the process, we heard from a number of mills concerned about possible impacts related to these concepts. Since then, as I've mentioned, we have met several times with legislators and stakeholder groups to respond to their questions, get feedback from them, and have discussed alternative concepts with them. We are confident that a proposal can be developed that meets the original goals of this rule concept without causing significant cost to existing businesses and protects public health. So with that, today here with me is Yuri Papish. He's the manager of our air quality program operations section, and Yuri's going to provide you with a little more specifics on the particular mission standards in our proposal. Yuri.
Thank you, Director Peterson, Chair Klemm, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Yuri Papish. I am the air quality program operations section manager at the Department of Environmental Quality. And as Director Peterson mentioned, we are looking at possible changes to the particulate standard, and they are just a small part of a larger, more comprehensive effort to update our permitting rules. And I'm the manager overseeing those rule development.
And is the update related to federal activity?
A lot of it, Chair Klemm, is related to updating old standards, fixing our definitions where we have some procedural things in our definitions, so we're taking them out, putting them where they should be. We have some redundant definitions in different sections. We're putting them in one place, and we actually had we had an example where we had the definition for the word person in different division sections of our rules, and there are different definitions, so we're going down to one definition. That's just an example, yeah. But it's a bunch of different things to clean up our rules. Mm-hmm. And before I proceed any further, I want to give you a little background on some terminology. There are a couple of different types of standards that I'm going to mention, and one standard is an emission standard. That is a limit at an individual company on how much particulates can be emitted at that company. So you could think of it as a end of pipe or end of smokestack standard at the company. And then there is the outside air quality standard, which is a limit on the pollution in the outside air, often referred to as the level in the airshed. So the outside air quality standard is set by, is a federal standard, and it's set by the Environmental Protection Agency. Mm-hmm. And they set that standard based on a determination of what is necessary to protect public health, based on health studies. That's how that level is set. The emission standard for particulates is set by the State Environmental Quality Commission, and that's set at a level to try to help achieve the outside air quality standard.
Emissions was the individual facility or source, and then the outside is more ambient or aggregated, sort of?
Correct. It is actually called the ambient air quality standard.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I simplified it.
Did you just say that a minute ago and I wasn't listening?
No, I just call it the outside air quality standard.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was confusing me because I know what the ambient air quality standard is.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard of the outside air.
They're the same thing.
Okay. Sorry.
So this emission standard for particulates applies to many different facilities, but only older boilers and a small number of asphalt plants may have difficulty meeting the Titan standard. The actual emission standard that we're talking about has not been updated in 40 years, although there have been a lot of upgrades to boilers and improvements in operation and improvements in technology. It's a normal practice of DEQ to periodically look at our rules to look at our standards to see if they're still appropriate given changes in the federal rules, changes in technology, and changes in air quality. We did a modeling analysis of three facilities with older boilers, pre-1970 boilers, and the modeling showed that at two of them, the levels of particulate in the airshed were at the level of concern for public health impacts. At the third site, we modeled, the level was not at that level of concern for health impacts, but there was still some significant emissions, and then there was limited room left in the airshed for new development. And I say this because when a new company comes in or a company wants to expand and they have significant air emissions, they are required to do a modeling analysis to show that their emissions, in addition to the other emissions already in the air, aren't going to exceed that outside air quality standard or ambient standard. And so from an economic and development perspective, it's important to leave a little bit of room in the airshed for new companies that want to get that want a site in a location so that they can get permitted. Otherwise, they may choose a different location or go elsewhere to get permitted.
Like China, where I've been. Not really quite like Oregon there, it turns out, in the air.
Mr. Charles.
Representative Holman.
So you mentioned that this emission standard hasn't changed in the last 40 years. Has the ambient air quality standard changed in the last 40 years that would make it more challenging for the emissions, I guess, pre-70 to continue to exist, I guess is what I'm guessing that's what I'm hearing. But.
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, yeah, that standard has tightened significantly. It was set at, back in 1972 when these rules were adopted, the outside air quality standard was at 260 micrograms per meter cubed. And it was actually total particulate standard. And then recently, just incorporated into our state rules in 2010, were changes that EPA made to that standard, and it's dropped down to 35, from 260 to 35. However, that's for fine particulate, the 35 standard. In the situation we're talking about here, from a boiler, it's the total particulate and the fine particulate are the same because it's fine particulate emissions coming out of those boilers almost entirely.
And to the earlier sort of, I think, question, why are you here in front of the Rural Communities Committee? Most of these boilers are in rural areas, if I understand right, or all of them are. Mm-hmm. And we think there's 11 maybe that Cogen kind of fit at least what. Well, we'll let Representative Springer talk. She's got a particular thing in mind that I was briefed about that is a certain type of facility doing certain things, and they're all in rural areas, and I think there's maybe a dozen or so. Okay.
We're being careful when we're considering a new emissions standard that improves public health but is also readily achievable and is not imposing undue cost on business.
Mm-hmm.
So we are forming a fiscal advisory committee to look at some alternative concepts we've come up with to give us recommendations on ways of mitigating fiscal impact from these rules. And I just wanted to mention...
Let me ask one question. I'm trying to process quickly, but the differences between urban areas and rural areas would be accounted for because it's a standard, like the boundaries of an airshed. How do you do that? Is it a certain radius, and then within a certain, you just take an you define an airshed by something on a map, and then study the air at different points around it, and I'm just thinking in urban areas, there's lots of cars, there's a lot more stuff going on that would contribute to it. In a rural area, not so much, you know, dozens of cars jammed up on 217 flowing into the airshed. So you're just talking some mills, some, you know, people burning wood stoves at home, things like that. But I'm trying to, do we have the same standards statewide, I guess, is my basic question.
Mm-hmm.
And how does that factor in the way we calculate these airsheds, urban versus rural?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have lines in the sky where these airsheds stop?
Well, yeah, that's
go?
What I'm trying to.
Yeah.
play this out in my head.
Or, and do they change when the wind changes?
Chair Club, the for the first part of your question, the standard, the outside air quality standard, the ambient standard is the same across the entire state.
Mm-hmm.
And we have monitors in different parts of the state to monitor particulate to see if it's over that level. The places where in Oregon where we've had difficulties have been in Klamath Falls, in Oak Ridge, and in Lakeview. Those are the current ones. And a lot of the pollution is coming from wood stoves.
Yeah.
And you get an inversion in wood stoves, so you'll have more particulate pollution there than in some of your cities.
So what that would be like a definition? If you put that monitor right, you know, by my dad's house, yeah, you're going to get a lot. If you put it a mile down the river, no, you're not going to get anything. So what's the boundary? How big is an airshed, and where do we stick our monitors?
Chair Clem, we have I'm not the expert on our modeling or putting our monitors out, but I know that they do they put a bunch of monitors in different places, and they try to in a community. A lot of times we've put monitors at schools. That's kind of representative. They try to find a representative location for a monitor for that community.
Especially where people are going to be, like a school, and that's good.
Right.
But is an airshed still, is that a... How do we define an airshed?
The airshed is... When I talk about a certain facility here, I just mean the surrounding areas to that facility.
I mean, for example, it becomes important because if you've got a cap kind of in an airshed and you need to leave room for a new development, what's the area?
Yeah.
You got to know that.
Yeah, Chair
Clem. You do. I need to know that. Sorry.
Yeah, Chair Clem, one of the factors that go in is what contributes to a local air. You know, where does the air settle out? Where does it come from? And that sort of thing that defines that. And it's different in different areas. So wherever a facility might be, what area does it contribute to? And that's and so every airshed is defined differently depending on weather patterns, geography, all the sorts of things.
Smart people with computers probably.
Right. Yeah,
figuring this stuff out, but
yeah. Well, one thing, Chair Clem, I wanted to point out, and it's been a point of discussion by a number of people, is monitoring, and there's a question about whether, in determining ambient air quality, whether you should just take an average of different samples from around this airshed. The way the monitoring is set up and designed by the Environmental Protection Agency is you look at a place that may be people that may be the most susceptible. Yuri brought up schools or other areas, and so whatever contributes to that area can impact that. So if we don't average samples across an airshed, if one monitor is located in this area and it exceeds the ambient air quality standards, then the airshed has a problem. And so that's what defines when we get to an area that this area that Yuri's talking about exceeds the outside or ambient air quality, then there's a problem. So that's why monitoring feeds into our look at an airshed, and that's defined by the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, I just, for whatever reason, I don't know anything about this. It's very interesting to me. Mm-hmm. I know you know quite a bit, actually. Please.
So are you saying that if there's a spike or there's a detected ambient air quality standard that exceeds the EPA standard, then the entire airshed is in violation because of it's been exceeded in one area and it is therefore deemed unhealthy for people to breathe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, the process for that is it's not quite that. If we get one spike above the level that the whole area, we actually need 3 years of monitored data showing that it's exceeding. And once we get that, then we determined around the monitor how large of an area it is, and we actually adopt a boundary that we determine is the area or the airshed that is in non-attainment with the federal standard. Once that happens, it triggers a whole series of other steps that are necessary to try to get that area back into attainment.
And Chair Klim, Representative Holby, correct me if I'm wrong, Yuri, but also it takes into account what the source of that violation might be. If it's a, an accidental fire or something like that, that's not really part of the sort of what's normally or through activity contributing to the airshed violation, then that's not counted. That's correct, right?
Correct. Yep. Yeah.
Oh, Chair Klim, I pardon my naivete here. I'd love to be educated more about this, but I see at times when we have an inversion and it's cold and people are burning their wood stoves in the Rogue Valley or in the Willamette Valley and you have issues, you can put out warnings asking people to manage things differently. Does that all fall into the purview of your department? Is that federal? Is that state? Educate me about how that works. I know you have problems when wood stoves are cranked up and right. You have an inversion.
Except for Lane County.
Chair Klim, Representative, there's a lot going on around the state, and some of it has been set statewide. There was passed by the legislature, I believe, a wood stove change-out program whereby if there's a house that sells and it has a wood stove, that wood stove has to be changed to a certified wood stove. So that's statewide.
Okay.
And then when there's a an area that's not meeting the airshed or ambient air quality, a local jurisdiction might have other things that they put in place, like more aggressive stop wood burning or change out. And there's been some grant money available to help for changing out wood stoves, older wood stoves. Wood stove burning is one of the major contributors to the areas that Yuri mentioned that are not meeting airshed ambient standards.
Well, and what I see, you run into the problem in the the rural communities where, a lot of people use that as a source because it's cost-effective for them, but it's creating an issue and they don't have the resources to upgrade. So you're saying it happens at the point of sale, but there may be other pots of money they can tap into even if it's not at a point of sale, so you can deal with this issue.
How do you
can't tell people not to heat their homes.
And how do you deal with anomalies like forest fires? When they would just add so much smoke and particulate into the air, do you discount that somehow?
Chair Klim, Representative Holvey, there I don't know the exact process for that, but there is some methodology for doing that. I understand it's our lab guys who do the monitoring and analyze the data.
So it's not like you can outlaw them, I suppose.
Forest fires?
Yeah.
No.
That'd be nice.
Chair Klim, Representative, just to add to that, there is what we call a smoke management plan that's implemented by the Oregon Department of Forestry that we collaborate with them on, and it is trying to get ahead of things like slash burning and other events that will lead to smoke in the air to make sure that those agencies, federal agencies included, look at weather patterns and things like that so it doesn't cause a problem. But natural forest fires, that doesn't count towards non-compliance in an airshed, I believe, when we're looking at ambient airshed quality.
Yeah, that's my understanding. It's also averaged over 3 years, data.
Mm-hmm.
And they're usually short duration.
So I've got two more speakers I want to get up. This is very helpful, and I appreciate your initial comments that you think we are going to get to something that people can live with as we go along here. That's comforting.
Yeah, you bet. Chair Klim, one thing I will add in our work with the facilities and the stakeholders with Representative Springer is we are certainly learning that these facilities that have older boilers have worked hard to upgrade them as best they can, have done a lot of things, so certainly that's part of what we're learning and being informed about and helping us make some decisions. So thank you very much.
I think generally cogen is quite important for a lot of other reasons too. I mean, the mills need to stay in operation so people have a job, obviously, like we just talked about earlier in rural communities, but the cogen, the other options are not ideal either in the scheme of things. You know, and so it's a good way to get, you know, get the steam off of some of the byproduct. It's a good, clean way to do it. And it's, you know, often material that otherwise has got to be trucked all over the place and or burned for no particular use. And so it's, you know, I'm glad that we know people are trying hard and we want to make this work because we don't want to lose these facilities either.
All right. Thank you.
And as they're walking away, you're calling up somebody else. I'll go ahead and let you do that.
Oh, make a comment. Would John Coleman come up?
Yeah. I know in our area we've had some air, ambient air quality issues, and as you're able to bring that, we've sited a new biomass plant down there, for example, and that wouldn't have been able to happen if our ambient air quality standard hadn't been, you know, I guess decreased over time to allow for, you know, some more room in the airshed to create new industry. So I mean, it's a tough balance to figure out how to deal with that.
Well, no, I mean, I know a lot of people who went to from America who went to live in China for their employer, and now they're refusing to stay. Like, it hurts the economy eventually when people don't want to live in really grotesque air conditions. They just pull up and leave, and then you can't get anybody who wants to be there anymore. So, plus, they're going to live, I think, an average of 5 years less in these cities now just because of the air.
Air quality,
I mean, it's not... We don't want to go there. So,
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Crawlman. I'm the staff attorney for Neighbors for Clean Air. We work with communities all around Oregon to help them understand and address air quality concerns, especially toxic air quality concerns. I wanted to speak today to emphasize how important updating these opacity and grain loading standards are in Oregon. My background is in chemical engineering, and I was actually a environmental consultant for several years before attending law school. And while working in Virginia, we were working with 10 and 20% opacity standards. When I first saw the 40% opacity standards that we have here in Oregon, I actually thought it was a typo. That is incredibly lax as a standard.
Excuse me, Chair Clem?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what's an opacity standard?
Sorry, I was just about to explain that. So opacity is a measurement of how much light extinguishment is caused by emissions. So
opaque opacity. Okay,
yes.
Got it. Thank you.
And the way that is measured, I think, is important to understand because it's not a specific moment in time. It's an average of recordings every 15 seconds over a six-minute period. So you take 24 measurements over a six-minute period, and you average those values, and that's what your opacity is. So when you say 40% opacity, you can have opacity of 100%, so it can be completely black for a minute. And as long as you get your opacity down in the next 5 minutes, that's not considered a violation. So this is really allows, at 40%, this really allows a source to dump a lot of particulates into the air. And these particulates are incredibly dangerous, especially the very fine particulates. They can get very deep into the lungs and cause lung problems, and some of them can even get into the bloodstream and cause heart problems, brain problems, strokes, heart attacks. So it is really important from a public health standpoint that we ensure that we are meeting federal standards, and even that we're better than federal standards, because while they're set based on health, they're incomplete tools. To answer your question, Representative Holvey, the way that forest fires are taken into account is they're just simply ignored. Data from those days is just thrown out and not even considered. So the health impacts from forest fires doesn't go into consideration of how we regulate industrial sources. It's also, these standards are always decreasing as EPA gets more and more health-based data. Ozone standards are always tightening up. PM standards, particulate matter standards, are always tightening up as we learn more and more about the health impacts from particulate matter and from other pollutants. So I think it's really important that DEQ update these standards to help communities with ensuring more room for development and also protecting members of the community and their health. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. I've been doing air quality work for about a decade now, so I know quite a bit about how the Clean Air Act works. So if the committee has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions for John?
Yeah.
we'll see if we have any more after our next speaker. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
Yep, you bet. Representative Springer. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for bringing this to our attention.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning still. For the record, I'm Sherry Springer, State Representative from House District 17. Represent 11 little cities and a handful of mills. They're very important to the people in my district. So I just wanted to weigh in on this issue a little bit, as I have become even more familiar with this issue in the last couple months, gained a greater understanding of mills, and I have been to likely the oldest mill in the state, which is not in my district, to mills with cogen plants and mills with boilers. And one thing I want to be clear with, this conversation is not, to my knowledge, involving cogen plants. That's not the animal that we're talking about. We're talking about boilers.
I might have misunderstood. Yeah.
We're talking about boilers, and we're talking about those pre-70 boilers. Mm-hmm. So one of the mills in my district, I've been there recently, they have made several hundreds of thousands of dollars in upgrades since the 70s. And I said, why? What rule made you do that? He said, well, none. It's the right thing to do. He says, as technology advances, we should upgrade these to make sure we're under requirements, whether it be the opacity or the source point emissions, whatever it would be. And they're under current standards. So they have done more proactively than they have been required to do. So another thing I want to mention about that is this is a conversation that, a piece of this conversation that I've really tried to get a better handle on so I could understand. This conversation, as I've looked for what precipitated it, what happened, what new rule came forward from the federal government, what has caused this to be on the front burner, if you will, right now. And it was just said a little bit ago, confirmed what I've been thinking. This is, to some extent, some cleanup in language, looking at definitions, some of which are outdated, some of which are not. And so let's remember that is, in part, if not in totality, what's driving the conversation. I'm not saying this is a bad conversation. I think it's a good conversation. I really do. I've learned a lot in the last couple months, and I was not new to mills by any stretch of the imagination, or new to airshed quality, or new to wood stoves and what they do. And I know the Springers would get pretty cranky if they had to give up their wood stove, because we like it. We just like it. But it's got the bells and the whistles, and it's efficient, and we get that. But there's people in my district that it's not about the bells and whistles. It's about having money to heat with, because they're in areas where they have wood, and that's typically free. So we need to be careful as we fold in the wood stove conversation, and what that means to folks. So you asked the question, Chair Clem, definition of airshed. And that's hard to wrap our arms around, isn't it? It just is. And I've done some work trying to figure out what that is. I looked on the DEQ's website because I wanted to see how they defined airshed. And unless I've missed it, it's not defined. It's referenced, but it's not defined. And I think that's important for us to try to understand what that issue means. So if you go to dictionary.com, because we do everything on our phones now, trying to figure out what this airshed is, it's a geographical area within which the air frequently is confined or channeled, with all parts of the area thus being subject to similar conditions of air pollution. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but that's what we have to work with, or at least what I'm working with now. So when we talk about that, we need to look at what goes into that airshed, and we need to look at the science that says exactly what that airshed is, not just modeling. Modeling I equate to our revenue forecasts. I really do. You can't necessarily nail something down, but you can take factors and conditions and plug them into a model and get an idea. And so I've been kind of equating this. Maybe you'll find something better to use to make that resonate for you. But I've been using the revenue forecast. And one thing I know about the revenue forecast, we all know about the revenue forecast, it's never right. It's close, but it's never right. So we need to talk about the modeling and then the science and how those two things are comparing. Our family moved out to where we can't see another house. And our neighbor's 180 acres of field, and we have more trees than I can count on our little 3 acres because of air quality in part and quality of life. So I get that piece, and I think that's very important. So we need to ask the question, what is enough and what is reasonable to expect if we're still going to live and exist within our environment? So as we talk about, it's been mentioned, I love nothing more than new industry. I love nothing more than new jobs, except the existing jobs that we do have. That's the only thing I love more than new jobs. And so we've talked a lot about we need to be careful with the air quality so there's room for new industry. I would absolutely agree. However, when you talk about the 11 mills that are primarily being discussed here, 3 asphalt plants, those are not areas people are knocking down the doors to bring their new industry. So I would just ask us to weigh that determining factor somewhere on the spectrum of what value we give that. The other thing is, as I talked about this one mill in particular and the upgrades they've made, and they're under the requirement today. The current requirements. They've gone above and beyond. We then need to also ask, what is significant cost? Because it's been said there's not a significant cost or undue cost. I think we need to have the industry weigh on that and talk about what is an undue cost and a significant cost. And the other thing I want to talk to you about is I have to confess to you, I could not get my head around opacity reading. So I was out at a mill, and I did an opacity reading. Let me tell you what that was. First of all, I'm not certified, and I don't know what I'm doing. Okay, let me qualify that. But I said to somebody who's been certified to take opacity readings, I said, take me out there and tell me how to do an opacity reading. So I stood out at a particular spot that he typically uses. You need to be consistent with that. Looked out, and the trees were the backdrop, just beautiful backdrop with the hillside there and the trees. And it was a visual assessment of how much the trees, in this case, were obscured. So when I looked out at this particular time, I said, well, is that zero? Because it was not obscured at that particular time. And he goes, no, that's probably 5-10%. And then we talked a little bit. 5 minutes later, I looked up and I said, oh, my gosh, there's more smoke, if you will. It's more blurred right now. What would that be? And he threw out a number, I don't know, maybe 15-20%, something like that, a little bit more. But it was still pretty clear. So I just want to share with you my experience of opacity readings, the subjectivity of them. Does that mean they're bad? No, it just means we need to have that in our heads as we move forward looking at this issue. I'll certainly answer any questions that you have. I'm not the expert in the room. I'm just the one learning about this issue and trying to figure out how to hold on to jobs. Some of the improvements that have been discussed will close some mills it wouldn't. I'm thinking of one mill in my area, 235 jobs in an area that doesn't have very many jobs. So that's pretty significant. So certainly if you have any questions, I'll answer those.
Any questions for our colleague?
With a very slim committee.
Well, we're already past it.
I think we'd all be concerned about something that would be shutting down a mill that would lose 235 jobs. I didn't get that indication from what I was hearing from DEQ as a seeming like a possibility. So I guess that's something we've got to figure out.
It is a possibility.
If that's going to happen, that's one thing.
Well, I think where we're at now is just a process just beginning, and well, there's been some, notification that there's this updating going on. to some people, updating makes them real nervous. What does that mean, updating? Mm-hmm. And so now there's a conversation, maybe later in a few weeks there's some meetings going on, and we wanted to get ahead of it a little bit and hear what you've been hearing in your stakeholder group so we can pay attention as we go forward.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, yeah. And I certainly want to thank DEQ. In the last, I don't know, 6 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever it is, this process has slowed down, and some of those they're not deadlines, just some of those desired dates have been pushed out a little bit, and I certainly want to show my appreciation for that and slowing this conversation down so we can get a better feel of really what we're talking about from an industry perspective. Mm-hmm.
I just make that comment. I just know over the past 40 years, there's been a lot of companies that have made improvements and, you know, have really stepped up and been able to, you know, accommodate those increasing restrictions. And, I mean, that's happened, well, like I say, over 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it... As those standards change, we need to be able to encourage people to change along with it. So I think that's a large part of what those standards are doing, and DEQ is trying to figure out a way to encourage people to get there so that we can maintain our compliance with those standards at the federal level. Because if we don't, I know we have dollars at risk, economic dollars at risk. So.
Well, we probably don't want the EPA coming in taking over our programs either. That's not...
And that would be another...
Generally speaking, industry doesn't like that. There's been a few cases where we've thought about having a federal agency admin or something, but usually we don't do that if we can help it. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm sure everybody else has other meetings they're late for too, but thank you for staying till the end, and thank everybody for coming, and thank you for staying, Representative Holby, and I will close our informational meeting and adjourn our interim committee. Committee.